CBS News Face the Nation in 60 seconds.
It's the new year, which means a fresh start for your business. And a great year starts with making great hires. But posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your jobs on all the top job sites. And now you can. With ZipRecruiter, you can jumpstart your hiring in 2017. Post your jobs to 200-plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 1 million businesses. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. That's ZipRecruiter.com/free trial.
Today on Face the Nation, with just 5 days until the inauguration of Donald Trump, a new era dawns in Washington. After a contentious press conference, his first in 168 days.
I think it was disgraceful that the intelligence agencies allowed any information that turned out to be so false and fake out. I think it's a disgrace. And that's something that Nazi Germany would have done and did do.
President-elect Donald Trump prepares to take the oath of office. We'll ask Vice President-elect Mike Pence about the latest investigation into Russian meddling, Donald Trump's relationship with the intelligence community and the press.
No, I'm not going to give you a question. You are fake news.
Then we'll turn to West Virginia Democrat Joe Manchin and the Senate's investigation into Russia's cyber espionage. Plus, more insight into America's 45th president from a top Trump transition advisor, Newt Gingrich. A deep dive into the ties between the new Trump staff and the Russians, and our weekly political panel. It's all ahead on Face the Nation. Good morning and welcome to Face the Nation. I'm John Dickerson. Vice President-elect Mike Pence starts off our broadcast this morning. Welcome, Mr. Vice President-elect.
Thank you, John.
5 days from now, you will be the vice president. Let's start with some news. The Republican chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee has decided to investigate Russian meddling in the election. That includes any possible contacts between the Russians trying to meddle and the Trump campaign. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I think the president-elect and I both welcome the Congress doing its oversight work in this and any other area. And we look forward to the results of their inquiry. But make no mistake about it, I think they'll find what the publicly released intelligence report showed before is that there's no evidence of any impact on voting machines. Donald Trump won this election fair and square. 30 out of 50 states, more counties than any Republican candidate since Ronald Reagan. And so while we certainly respect the right of the Congress to provide oversight, to make inquiries where they deem them appropriate, this the American people spoke in this election, and the peaceful transition of power that'll take place this coming Friday on a platform where our president-elect will take the oath of office, surrounded by four of the five living presidents, is a testament to our democracy, and I'm incredibly humbled to be a part of it, John.
Last week, before that intelligence briefing, the president-elect said he felt like this. All these questions were part of a witch hunt. He's now had some new information. There's now the Senate Intelligence Committee. So he no longer thinks this is a witch hunt, this investigation into Russian meddling. Is that fair to say?
Well, I think that there frankly has just been an effort by many in the national media, present company accepted, since this election to essentially demean and question the legitimacy of this incoming administration. And talk of that, sources within the intelligence community that have been attributed with sharing that information, public officials, I think is a real disservice to our democracy. As I said, Donald Trump won a landslide election. The American people spoke decisively. They wanted change. And I promise them, come noon this coming Friday, change really begins, and we're going to make America great again.
But there's a distinction between that feeling about the press and legitimate inquiry, as you say, that the Senate Intelligence Committee is doing. Just to button up one question, did any advisor or anybody in the Trump campaign have any contact with the Russians who are trying to to meddle in the election?
Well, of course not. And I think to suggest that is to give credence to some of these bizarre rumors that have swirled around the candidacy, and the fact that a few news organizations, not this one,
right,
actually trafficked in a memo that was produced as opposition research and associated that with intelligence efforts, I think could only be attributed to media bias. And as I said this week at the press conference, John, the American people are tired of it. We're coming into this week with a great sense of optimism. The American people know that we can have government in Washington, D.C. as good as our people. We can get this economy moving again. We can rebuild our military.
Let me move on.
We can be standing tall in the world again. And those are the reasons why Donald Trump is going to take that oath of office on Friday.
Let's move to the world. What does Donald Trump feel about Vladimir Putin and Russia?
Well, I think in the president-elect, you have someone who is willing to approach this terrible relationship the United States has with Russia today with fresh eyes, and to at least be open to a better relationship with Vladimir Putin and with Russia. Look, we have some common interests that would be well served if we were able to improve our relationship with Russia, most notably the battle to defeat radical Islamic terrorism and to defeat ISIS at its source. But I think the president-elect also made it clear this week, John, that while a better relationship with Russia would be a good thing, that I think he's realistic about the possibility of that. Mm-hmm. And I think when you see the cabinet that he's assembled,
in
General Mattis and Senator Coates and Mike Pompeo, we're coming at this with realistic expectations, but the president-elect is determined to reengage the world on put America first and see if we can make progress for the security and peace of the world.
Let me ask you about that, because the picture that Donald Trump puts forward about his view of Russia seems quite different than the gentleman you mentioned, incoming Secretary of Defense Mattis and then also Secretary of State Tillerson. Mr. Tillerson said Russia poses a danger. He called Russia an adversary. He said there are a number of areas where America is going to have to confront Russia. That's not an opinion. That's confrontation. Mr. Mattis said the most important thing to recognize is that Putin is trying to break the North Atlantic alliance. My question is, if the American people are listening to Mr. Trump and listening to those men, and more importantly, countries overseas are listening, who's driving the bus, Mr. Trump or those two men?
Well, the great thing about being around Donald Trump is you never have any confusion about who's driving the bus and where the buck stops and who will make the final decision. But I think as you hear the testimony of Rex Tillerson, of General Mattis, of Mike Pompeo, I think the American people will be greatly encouraged by the fact that the president-elect is assembling around him people of extraordinary background and capability. Who will bring their own experience and their own perspective to inform the president's decisions. But ultimately, the president will make the best decision, the best interest of the American people.
Because on the one hand, you have Mattis and Tillerson saying, confront Russia. Donald Trump doesn't sound like a guy who wants to confront Russia.
Well, you know, if you listen carefully to that press conference this week, and I was standing just alongside of him at the time, that he said it'd be good if we had a better relationship with Russia.
But does he want to say demand?
He said, I hope it gets better, but he said, maybe not.
But does, say, Donald Trump demand that Russia get out of eastern Ukraine? That would be a confrontation that certainly Mattis and Tillerson would, in the context of what they've said, sounds like that's what they want. Does Donald Trump want Russians out of eastern Ukraine?
Well, let's be very clear that whether it be eastern Ukraine or Crimea, that the action by the Russians has demonstrated the absence of American leadership over the last 4 to 8
years. Yeah, new leadership.
What's
the new leadership want to do?
Well, I think America is going to be more respected in the world the very moment that Donald Trump takes the oath of office as the 45th president of the United States. And he'll work through these issues, John. Okay. I think what the country should be encouraged by is whether it be Rex Tillerson as our Secretary of State, Nikki Haley going to the United Nations, General Mattis, is that he is surrounding himself with a group of men and women that are going to bring the broadest range of experience, inform his decisions, and he'll take the kind of actions and make the kind of decisions that will put America first.
Mr. Tillerson said he hadn't had a conversation about Russia with Donald Trump. How can that be?
Well, I think in the context of these confirmation hearings, the president-elect has made a point to talk to each of the various candidates for these positions. And the nature of those conversations is usually wide-ranging. And so I
accept
what Rex Tillerson
said. To get Russia in there. I guess the point is, if Donald Trump's driving the bus, shouldn't his Secretary of State know where the bus is going?
I think Rex Tillerson will have and has no confusion about who will be making the decisions in the Trump administration. And that's true of all of us. I mean, what's so encouraging to be around Donald Trump and to literally be sitting side by side with him during the course of this transition, when he's done hundreds of interviews and made decisions, attracted men and women of extraordinary caliber to this cabinet. I think we may well have the entire cabinet name before the inauguration. Is to see a leader who is decisive. He asks incisive questions. He gets straight to the point. He knows what he's looking for, and when he sees it, he makes the decision.
Let me ask you about it. Was reported by David Ignatius that the incoming National Security Advisor, Michael Flynn, was in touch with the Russian ambassador on the day the United States government announced sanctions for Russian interference with the election. Did that contact help with that Russian kind of moderate response to it, that there was no counter-reaction from Russia? Did the Flynn conversation help pave the way for that sort of more temperate Russian response?
I talked to General Flynn about that conversation. It actually was initiated when, on Christmas Day, he had sent a text to the Russian ambassador to express not only Christmas wishes, but sympathy for the loss of life in the airplane crash that took place. It was strictly coincidental that they had a conversation. They did not discuss anything having to do with the United States' decision to expel diplomats or impose a censure against Russia.
So did they ever have a conversation about sanctions ever on those days or any other day?
They did not have a discussion contemporaneous with U.S. action.
But what about ever?
My conversation with General Flynn. Well, look, General Flynn has been in touch with diplomatic leaders and security leaders in some 30 countries. That's exactly what the incoming National Security Advisor should do. But what I can confirm, having spoken to him about it, is that those conversations that happen to occur around the time that the United States took action to expel diplomats had nothing whatsoever to do with those sanctions.
But that still leaves open the possibility that there might have been other conversations about the sanctions.
I don't believe there were more conversations.
Let's move on.
But I can confirm that those elements were not part of that discussion.
Congressman John Lewis, who you serve with, Democrat, told on Meet the Press that he did not consider Donald Trump a legitimate president. Your reaction to that?
Well, Donald Trump won this election fair and square. 30 out of 50 states, including Georgia, more counties than any Republican candidate since Ronald Reagan. And to hear John Lewis, a man that I served with, that I respect, to question the legitimacy of the election and to say that Donald Trump will not be a legitimate president was deeply disappointing to me, and also to hear that he was not going to attend the inauguration this Friday. I hope he reconsiders both statements. Look, this is a time when we're facing real challenges at home and abroad, and I believe the inauguration ceremony itself and this moment in history would greatly benefit if we set aside these baseless assertions about the legitimacy of the election and we looked for ways to come together, to work together. And the president-elect actually, in a tweet late last night, invited Congressman Lewis to work with us to bring more prosperity, better schools, more safety to our cities around the country.
Let me ask you about a tweet he sent before that tweet, in which he defended himself, famous counterpuncher. Donald Trump said that John Lewis was all talk and no action. I've got a question. He has every right to defend himself. Let me ask you about the wisdom of defending himself. For 5 years, Donald Trump questioned the legitimacy of Barack Obama, said he wasn't born in America, was really the chief advocate of this so-called birther idea. Given that history, given that he's about to be president, why swing at this pitch? Couldn't he have just let it go by, be the bigger man, let John Lewis do his thing, move on? He's about to be president of the United States, as you say, all those challenges, bringing the country together. Why swing at this pitch?
Well, I just, as you said, Donald Trump has every right to defend himself. And to have someone...
But he did challenge the legitimacy of President Obama, so why not?
But to have someone like John Lewis, who, look, I served with John. I disagreed with him on most issues, but I had tremendous respect for him. And I actually, my family and I walked across the Edmund Pettus Bridge with him on the 65th anniversary of Bloody Sunday. We honor the sacrifice that he made, but part of the result of what happened on Bloody Sunday and the courage that he showed was the Voting Rights Act. And so for someone of his stature, not just in the civil rights movement, but in voting rights, to make a comment that he did not consider Donald Trump to be a legitimate president, I think is deeply disappointing. Look, I attended both of Barack Obama's inaugurations, one as a congressman and one as a governor, because I believe inaugurations are a moment when we should come together around that individual who has been elected to be president of the United States of America. Donald Trump said it on election night, John, that he's determined to be president of all of the people of this country. And I do hope that John Lewis will reconsider his statement, but also will reconsider attending the inauguration. Mm-hmm. Will join us so that we can come together to take on the intractable problems that have been facing Americans, particularly too many families in our inner cities that are beset by unsafe streets, failing schools, and the lack of jobs and opportunities.
One final question. Esquire has a report that the Trump administration is thinking of moving the press out of the White House. Is that a logistical move or a punitive move?
I think no decision's been made on that yet. As you know, having been in this town a lot longer than me, the White House is actually 18 acres, and I think what the team told me is there's such a tremendous amount of interest in this incoming administration that they're giving some consideration to finding a larger venue on the 18 acres in the White House complex to accommodate the extraordinary interest. The White House press room, which you've served in, John, is actually it's a pretty small room, and I think the interest of the team is to make sure that we accommodate the broadest number of people who are interested in media from around the country and around the world. But we're working that out in a way that'll reflect our commitment to transparency, to a free and independent press, and we look forward to those days.
If you get rid of the press briefing room, you can create more room for the daily press guys who have to be there every day. So you got more room there for the more of them.
I'll pass that along.
Thank you very much, Mr. Vice President-elect. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, John.
Joining us now from Charleston, West Virginia, is Democratic Senator Joe Manchin, who serves on the Senate Intelligence Committee. Senator, I want to ask you about the committee. Senator Burr, who is the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, said, quote, "We don't have anything to do with political campaigns," when asked if the committee was going to investigate this idea of Russians trying to affect the election. But then that opinion was changed, and the Intelligence Committee is now going to look into that issue and whether there were any connections with the Russians and the Trump campaign. So what happened between when he said that and now the decision to actually hold hearings?
Well, Senator Warner is our ranking member on the committee. I'm brand new on the committee, and I'm very proud to be on this committee, and I'm learning an awful lot. But I think that Senator Burr, my dear friend, saw the interest that we all have and basically seen the interest of the American people, that we want to find out the intent of the Russians, to what extent the Russians are involved. And the American people need to know. Our colleagues need to know. We believe, and I believe now, that the committee that we have, the Intelligence Committee, is the best committee to do it in. And we can do, John, quite a bit of open meetings there in that committee also, once we get to the classified status, and then we have to go into our closed meetings. So we can do better, I think, and quicker to get people informed. The committee is professionally staffed. They know what they're doing, and I have an awful lot of faith and confidence in them, and we're going to get to the bottom of this very quickly. And I'm glad they changed the direction. I'm happy for the statement to both Senator Burr and Senator Warner have made now. We're working together, and that's a great committee with people who really care and they want to take politics out. It's about the security of our nation, not the politics of our nation.
There is a spectrum of responses to the Russian actions. On the one hand, some intelligence officials say this was an unprecedented effort to try to influence the U.S. election. On the other hand, incoming Chief of Staff Reince Priebus in the Trump team says, you know, this is a pattern. The Russians have been doing this for 50 years. So just, you know, which seems to suggest this is just not a new thing. Where do you put yourself on that spectrum?
Well, first of all, both statements are correct, John. The Soviets back in the 60s and 70s have been involved. We know they've been involved, and they've been trying to be involved in many ways, whether it be advertising or support and trying to change those who they thought would be harmful to the Kremlin. And now with Russia taking it to an unprecedented level, we're seeing, and everything has been reported in an unclassified way, that they have been involved more direct than any time in the past. So it's very troubling to find out at what level and to the extent they've gone to and where that's come from. That's what we're going to find out. That's what the American people want to know, and it's what my colleagues should know. So we know basically their true intent, and we cannot let them be involved in basically altering our political process.
Let me ask you about the incoming Trump administration. You've met with the president-elect. You've met also with Mike Pence. What is your message to Democrats who are nervous about the incoming administration?
Well, I mean, I would approach this as I would anything else. I'm very appreciative they've reached out to me, and knowing that I'm a centrist, a moderate, dead in the center, if you will, where I think most Americans are. That means we have to work together. They're willing to cross over in the aisle. They're willing to cross over and meet me halfway. I'm definitely going to cross over and try to meet with them to find a pathway forward. That'll be my job. With them, I would tell all my colleagues, let's just try to do the work of the people of this great country. Let's make sure we know we're Americans first. The process of elections, the politics is behind us, or it should be. The election's over. Donald Trump has been elected. He is our incoming president. We should all want, no matter who our president is, to be the best they can be, to be successful, because if they do well, our country does extremely well. My state of West Virginia does extremely well. So I'm going to work and try to a most productive manner, Senator, to make sure we're moving in the right direction. And I will always do that.
Senator, what do you think of Congressman John Lewis's decision to not attend the inauguration and some other of his colleagues making that same decision?
John, I've got the utmost respect for Congressman Lewis. He's an icon, if you will, and we all have the most respect for him. I just think that was uncalled for. I just wish that rhetoric would tone down from both back and forth. The bottom line is, if we're concerned about the Russians and we know the Russians want to be involved, Putin wants to be involved in altering our process, then he will succeed if he sees this bickering going back and forth. That's what we have to stop. We're bigger than this, and we're going to show them they're not going to change and not going to alter how we work and function as Congress, as a government, and the United States of America. We're not going to let that happen. So for this type of rhetoric, it's non-productive. And I would like, if that would tone down a little bit, we'd be much better off and move on.
All right, Senator Manchin, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks so much for being with us. We're joined now by former House Speaker and Trump Transition Vice Chairman Newt Gingrich. Mr. Speaker, I want to help you. I want to ask you to help us. You need no help from me. What I'd like to ask you is help us think through. Mike Pence says Donald Trump is driving the bus. But on Russia, Donald Trump has one view. He doesn't talk about Russia as an adversary. He doesn't talk about confronting. But his secretaries of state and defense talk about Russia as a clear and present adversary, says America needs to confront Russia. If I'm a American citizen or a foreign country, how do I make sense of those two things?
Well, I think, first of all, you realize that Trump has selected very, very knowledgeable people. I mean, it'd be hard to be better than General Mattis going into the Defense Department. I think Rex Tillerson brings an astonishing level of achievement negotiating with foreign countries. So you know that when they have councils to talk about policy, mm-hmm. he's going to have very sophisticated advice. What you also know is that he is his own person. I mean, this is a guy who has been, he's an entrepreneur. He's not a corporate CEO. He's not a guy who says, I want my staff to give me three options. What he wants is various people to give him 30 options. And then he's going to pick what he believes in. And I suspect he fully expects Mattis and Tillerson to implement the Trump policy.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with former Speaker Gingrich. Don't go away.
Not available in all states.
Hey, you two, what brings you to the mall?
We're just here checking on our robot.
Your robot?
Yeah, our recent Irby's Froyo robot. Diane and I became franchisees last month.
And couldn't be happier. It serves premier frozen yogurt creations to customers in 60 seconds. And the yogurt is delicious.
Yep, our customers absolutely love it. That's it over there.
Whoa, that's incredible. People really do love your Froyo robot. So you own this?
Sure do. Reese and Irvy's Froyo robots are available across the country, and it's super easy. Reese and Irvy's provided us with everything we needed. They even help you secure amazing locations. Movie theaters, grocery stores, college campuses, theme parks. They make any location a sensation.
And everyone loves frozen yogurt. That's incredible. How do I get a Froyo robot of my own?
You just go to froyorobots.com and enter promo code 8888. But hurry, because locations and robots are going fast.
Froyo.
Yeah, froyorobots.com. Promo code 8888.
We're back with former House Speaker and Trump transition Vice Chairman Newt Gingrich. I want to pick up where we left off. You talked about how Donald Trump is going to sift through all of his opinions from various advisors. What do they think in foreign capitals, though, when they hear two different things or many? If they hear 30 different things, how do they make decisions based on what they think the Trump administration is going to do?
Well, I think foreign capital is going to be a lot like the American press corps. I mean, and like most citizens, we're going to go through a period here of adjustment to the fact that we have the first truly entrepreneurial president we've seen in modern times. And I think you have to go back to Theodore Roosevelt to get the same level of daily energy and drive and confusion. And the confusion is caught because he's not staffed. Right. You know, he has people near him who try to understand him. But he, you know, Donald J. Trump got to be president his way. And he's going to be president his way. And the fact is, the rest of the planet is going to have to, for better or worse, learn how to cope with a president who's very complicated.
In foreign capitals, that can mean, though, building a bigger military. It can mean making alliances. I mean,
it can mean a lot of phone calls, for example, from the foreign minister to Tillerson saying, Rex, you know, what is this guy doing? And it means that Mattis and Tillerson have a really large assignment. And so does Nikki Haley up at the United Nations, because they're the explainers who have to be able to go both ways. That is, walk in and say, you know, Mr. President, what you said yesterday was interpreted the following way. And he'll learn from that. I mean, it'll be a 90-day cycle of real learning.
Let me ask you about interpretations in the intelligence community. Donald Trump takes over the intelligence community in 5 days.
Right.
He referred to them twice and compared them to the Nazis. You need trust in that relationship. If his first reaction is to think the intelligence agencies are trying to do him wrong and compares them to the Nazis, that does not suggest a relationship of trust.
Well, I don't think there should be a good relationship right now. I mean, I've spent a lot of my career, as you know, dealing with the intelligence community. Now, I want to make 2 points. One, the very top people who are political appointees, I think, absolutely betrayed and undermined the intelligence community. I think they acted in ways that were totally inappropriate. Two.
In this specific context.
Mm-hmm. They also did, by the way, in Benghazi. If you go back and look at how the CIA agreed to restate the facts in a way that was totally false. I mean, this is at the political appointee level, mm-hmm. which has really been corrupted by the Obama administration. There's a second part, though, which may just be a reference to the general decay of American education. How do you get a report that apparently John McCain passed in December that says that this one person, a real human being, was in Prague, and in all of that time, in 10 months, 11 months, nobody in the intelligence community picked up the phone and said, have you ever been to the Czech Republic? I mean, think about the level of incompetence.
Well, I guess my question, though, is how do you work then with this?
I hope what he does is say to the new director of national intelligence, Dan Coats, I expect you to thoroughly overhaul the entire community.
Let me ask you this. You know about big change. You came in after the elections of 1994. What's the biggest obstacle when you want to do a lot of things very quickly that Donald Trump faces?
Well, I think they've got to decide what the top 3 to 5 things are. Stay focused on them every morning as long as they can until they get them done. As they check them off, they add a new one. But they can't do more than 3 to 5. Obamacare is clearly going to be decisive. Jobs is the centerpiece of this administration. As he said at one point, he has 3 goals, jobs, jobs, jobs. If he succeeds with that, then he will have met his contract with the American people.
So you said stay focused. Is that the
Absolutely.
Key question?
It's the hardest
so the
thing,
key challenge
the hardest
is staying
thing
focused.
For a president to do is remember why they got up in the morning and what they're trying to accomplish. Reagan was a genius at it. He had 3 things. He's focused on them for 8 solid years, and he changed history.
Do you think that's a particular challenge for this president, the focus one?
Well, no. I think he built his empire by being very good at staying focused. I mean,
all right. Speaker Gingrich, thank you so much for being with us. We're joined now by The Washington Post's David Ignatius, who's been covering Russia's involvement in the cyber attacks during the 2016 campaign. David, I want to start with the Senate Intelligence Committee. They've decided to look into the whole question, but in particular also Russia connecting with the Trump campaign. What is the most important question they need to answer?
Well, I think first it's important that Vice President-elect Pence welcome that investigation, implicitly committed to support it. I think they need to get to the bottom of the issues that were raised in this unsubstantiated, so far as we know, inaccurate dossier that was compiled about contacts between members of the Trump campaign and Russia during what is now a confirmed Russian covert action against our political system. That's job one. I think it's important when we think about the Senate investigation to remember that there's also an FBI investigation that, it's my understanding, is still open into these same issues. It's important that that investigation be allowed to be completed, that there be no intervention to shut that down. And I hope members of the incoming administration will commit to let that investigation run its course, issue findings, and then establish basic facts. We get out of fake news into real facts.
What do you make of the fact that Chairman Burr at one point was saying he wasn't going to investigate and now is?
I thought Senator Manchin said something important this morning, that there has been a change. The Republicans who didn't think this was necessary now do think it's necessary. And that tells the American public there is something here worth looking at.
You've also been writing about Michael Flynn, the incoming national security advisor, and contacts with the Russians. Mike Pence said whatever the contacts may have been, they never discussed the question of U.S. sanctions on Russia. Explain what you take away from that.
I thought that the vice president-elect missed the larger point. It's not a question of whether sanctions were discussed, but whether these meetings that were essentially contemporaneous with the announcement of sanctions undercut them. Mm-hmm. This was a significant response by the U.S. government to what it perceived as a Russian attack on our political system. Did talking with the Russian ambassador about future contacts between Trump and Putin and about, we now know, invitation of a representative of the new administration to a meeting in Kazakhstan in January. Did that undercut this effort to punish Russia for bad behavior? And I think that's really the issue.
Right. So it doesn't matter what they talked about. It was, on the one hand, American policy is saying you've done something bad. On the other, conversations are suggesting
John,
the future.
Even taking their own account of what they talked about, I think there's still an issue. Did those subjects, did that discussion undercut the president's policy? We have one president at a time. That's just a fact. And these sanctions were a significant move by that president, and were they undercut?
Let me ask you about the cabinet officials who were up for confirmation hearings this week in the Senate. What did you make about the disconnect between what Donald Trump has said on Russia and issues of waterboarding and what we heard from his top officials?
Well, Vice President-elect said that President Trump will be driving the bus in answer to your question. As I look at this, and I've covered foreign policy going back to the 70s, I'm embarrassed to say, I have seen this movie before, divided administrations with sharply differing viewpoints on policy have occurred often, and they're very difficult for presidents to manage. You know, all this stuff about being an entrepreneur and listening, you know, you get a divided administration on an issue like Russia policy, and we now see a clear division between people close to Trump who want a much more rapprochement with Russia and people close to Pence who seem to strongly resist that. That's a recipe for real turbulence in the early weeks, months of an administration.
And what is that? What's the practical result or effect of that turbulence in a way that people can
confusing American policy, uncertainty among our allies? I just would note one final thing, John. It's possible that this whole effort to hack our political system, to destabilize U.S. politics, is backfiring for Russia. It is beginning to generate real resistance. You could hear that in the testimony that General Mattis gave, that Rex Tillerson gave, that Mike Pompeo, the CIA nominee, gave. I mean, they were pushing back against Russian aggression, and I think that's, if you're sitting in the Kremlin, you were probably going, this is going great. This week, you may have begun to think, this isn't going so great.
And then their hope would have to be that the man at the top has just a different view than the people who speak for him.
Well, it's going to be harder for Trump. It's just assuming Trump really thinks, I can be friends with Vladimir Putin and that's good for the world. It's going to be harder to do that in the environment that this hacking scandal has created.
Okay, David Ignatius, thank you so much. And we'll be right back in a moment with our political panel.
Check out CBS Radio News podcasts. From hard news to features, there's lots available from our app. Listen to experts like John Dickerson each Sunday on Face the Nation or Scott Pelley every weeknight on the CBS Evening News. There's the World News Roundup, America's longest-running network newscast, and the Weekend Roundup, our weekend review magazine show. It's all available from CBSRadioNews.com or on our app for iOS and Android.
And now we turn to our politics panel. Ruth Marcus is a columnist and deputy editorial page editor at The Washington Post. Ben Domenech is the publisher of The Federalist. John Heilman is from Bloomberg Politics. And Ed O'Keefe covers politics for The Washington Post. Ed, I cut you off last time you were on the broadcast. So I'm starting with you. New president in 5 days. Give us your lay of the landscape.
Well, you know, I think it's important, despite what the vice president-elect said about 30 out of 50 states in a landslide, to remember, if you look at polling that was out this week, only 37% of Americans have a favorable opinion of the president-elect. That is a, at least modern history, historic low. Usually you see a bounce for someone who wins, and he didn't really ever see one. The other thing I think that's important in those numbers, 34% believe he'd be a better leader than President Obama, also a pretty poor showing on that regard. And the one that I keep coming back to, 2-1, Americans believe he needs to stop tweeting. And I think given what we've seen this weekend, one wonders if we'll see that. There's certainly suggestions today from the vice president-elect that that won't happen. But I think that really, really eats at the craw of a lot of people who are concerned about him becoming president, that he's not necessarily trying to be the leader of all. He's trying to perhaps just be the leader of those 30 or 50 states.
Right. Ben, what do you make of those numbers for Donald Trump as he comes in?
I think it really says how much more important this inaugural address is going to be compared to perhaps other ones. The tone that Trump takes, the tone that he really has when he comes and speaks in front of the American people is going to send a message one way or the other. Is it a unifying tone? Is it sounding a note of optimism about an ability to work across partisan lines to be a non-traditional president in a way that benefits the American people? Or does he give them an address that is more, I come not to bring peace but the sword, a message of really anti-Washington, anti-elite sentiment that says to the American people, the people who voted for him, that he is going to be their champion and return power back to them away from the Washington elite that they so despise. I think that that decision is really going to have a lot of impact in the early days of his presidency, particularly given that he's going to be announcing one of his most controversial decisions, or what is likely to be, in the first couple of weeks, and that is his Supreme Court nomination, which is likely to put everyone back in their normal trenches when it comes to Democrats and Republicans.
I think Ben is right. A healing and welcoming tone in the inaugural address is necessary, but it's not sufficient. On election night, Donald Trump said the right thing. He said he wanted to bind the wounds of division. Almost everything that he's done since then has been not binding wounds, but exposing them. And it's not necessarily that he continues to tweet, because I think we know he's going to do that. It's what he tweets. And it's not necessarily what he'll say in the inaugural address, because I assume he will rise to the occasion. I certainly hope so. But it's how he behaves afterwards. And he needs to start behaving like the healer in chief.
John, your view.
Even after the contentiousness of the 2000 election, where many people thought that George W. Bush was given the presidency by the Supreme Court, Bush entered office with a 61% approval rating, even with all of that division then. So the approval rating matters a lot. If he's going to be a successful president, he needs to reach out and build a broader base. He did not win the popular vote. He won very narrowly in the Electoral College. I think he's 100% legitimate as a president, but that is a political challenge he faces. He also faces another set of challenges, which is that normally the reason you get a honeymoon as president-elect and then as president is that you start with a clean slate. On the questions of Russia and this election and now these questions that David was just talking about on the show, and on the questions of his business conflicts, these are large-scale potential scandals or controversies that he brings with him into the office. There are ethics specialists of Democrat and Republican stripe alike who say that he's going to be sued the moment that he takes the oath of office on the basis of the fact that he is violating the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution because he hasn't untangled his business empire. Those are, whatever you think of them on the merits, huge political challenges for a new president to come in with that much baggage attached to their wagon.
And there's other baggage, John, that isn't necessarily his doing, but we were reminded of it this week, which is the feeling that many people have out there that FBI Director James Comey unfairly and inappropriately and effectively, even whatever his intention was, intervened in the election. Now we know we're going to have two continuing investigations, right, plus the potential ethics issues, the essential look into Russia, and the inspector general who is going to be looking behind the scenes. It will take months, possibly a year, to look into Comey's behavior. And what that means is we have this very fragile and volatile state in our democracy. A lot of people who may not question Trump's legitimacy, but question what has gone on here, and we're going to keep going.
Let me ask you this, though, Ben. While that's all going on, there's going to be a lot of, Sturm und Drang. Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell are going to be passing legislation. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what I wonder is whether some of this is... Well, just give me your sense of that. I mean, there's another actor in the party here, too.
You know, the thing that's interesting about the mood on Capitol Hill among Republicans right now is that there are a couple different classes. There are people who are very optimistic right now that they are going to be able to pass through legislation that they've been trying to advance for the past 6, 8, 10 years without success, that they're going to pass that through Congress and that Donald Trump is going to rubber stamp it and not really play a significant role in changing it. That's the mood, certainly, among a lot of Republican leaders. At the same time, there's a camp of people who I would put in the sort of skeptical camp among the Republicans who feel like they're going to be able to work with Donald Trump on a handful of issues, but then also have to balance against him on other counts. And I think a good example of that is someone like Rand Paul, who has been out there vocally supporting Donald Trump's commitment to pass a replacement for Obamacare very soon after repeal. But that's the kind of aggressive step that Paul and Trump can agree on. But he is also preparing, along with a lot of the other libertarian leaders, members of the Congress, to balance against Donald Trump when it comes to all sorts of issues related to civil liberties, right, where they feel like this administration is not going to be as aligned.
And Ed McConnell's going to need 60 votes in the Senate. And if we have this kind of conflict that we've been talking about, Democrats are going to pay a price for working with Donald Trump.
They're going to pay a price for working with him. Republicans may pay a price for not getting any Democrats to play along with them. It's been 2 weeks of the new Congress and say that, you know, on the Senate side, there are some genuine attempts at cooperation underway. I think you saw Joe Manchin earlier talking about the eagerness to do it. He needs to do it, frankly, if he expects to be reelected. Mm-hmm. Heidi Heitkamp, Joe Donnelly, Claire McCaskill, among others, have to think about it as Democrats. But, you know, I would caution, things up there are pretty hot right now. I think the comments made by John Lewis this weekend had as much to do with the presidency as it does with the tinderbox nature of the House right now. If you look at what's gone on up there, kind of under the radar with all the focus on the administration in waiting, you've had attempts to undo an ethics office. You've had stiff penalties put in place on members who may try to act out on the House floor. They're seen as sort of retribution against Democrats. Amid that, you had a Republican congressman suggest that Mexican performers who were campaigning in Nevada with Democrats were just as much trying to influence the election on behalf of Mexico as the hackers did for Russia. And then you have this fight over, you know, art hanging on the walls of the Capitol and whether or not some of it was appropriate. All these little things, you know, add up. And at some point, if there is no check on this or if there's no attempt at cooperation, I think you could see some real trouble for Republican stewardship of Congress.
John, what do you make of the drive the bus question I was trying to get at, which is Donald Trump has a set of views on Russia, on torture, that seem at odds with the people who are going to head his cabinet?
Well, I agree with David on all issues, right? That there, like, not just on some specific things. I mean, across the board, in the sense that Donald Trump is driving the bus. Donald Trump is going to drive the bus. He drove the bus on his campaign. He is a bus driver at heart, right? But the reality is that some rules of physics are not repealed by Donald Trump being president. And those rules go back years in this city in politics, which is that if you have a Secretary of Defense and a National Security Advisor who are at war, it is a problem for your foreign policy. If you have big divisions between the agencies, broadly speaking, and the White House staff, it is a problem. Mm-hmm. And so, especially, it's always a problem, but it's a particularly potentially large problem for a president of the United States who has never run, has no government experience whatsoever, and is dealing with, not in the agencies, but in the White House, the least experienced staff in this city of any presidency that we've ever seen.
But I think the real issue here is that with all of these different types of folks in this cabinet, representing different viewpoints and having a lot of different backgrounds, we're not going to really know who Donald Trump is listening to on each of these subjects until a moment of crisis.
Right.
We learned in the early days of the Bush administration, after the interaction with the Chinese spy plane incident, we learned that George W. Bush was listening more to the Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice school than we might have expected, given some of his other choices going in. We're going to find out which of these folks he's named he actually listens to once there's a moment of crisis.
Or speaks to, because that was some of the astonishing testimony that we had this week about conversations that weren't had with the president-elect and his Secretary of State nominee about Russia, or with the nominee to head Homeland Security about immigration policy. The bus, he is the bus driver. Has he spoken to his passengers? Has he spoken to, or the members of his fleet? And Newt Gingrich used the word entrepreneurial about his leadership style. Another word for that might be less polite, might be incoherent.
Or improvisational.
Or both. Let me dismount from the bus metaphors for a moment. Go ahead.
I wanted to continue it just one more moment, because we just want to caution that whether he's talked to the passenger is one thing. Who's going to actually be on the bus remains an open question. Right. We have seen Republicans doubt whether Tillerson can do the job, and if they hold out this week on him or in the coming weeks, he may not board that bus. It's just worth pointing out that there are Republicans that are still concerned about him getting the job. Right?
Ben, give me your sense of Obamacare. Donald Trump really raised the bar this week in his press conference. He said not only will it be repealed and replaced, he said simultaneously, that was his word, but it will be much better and cost less.
He has promised an enormous number of things to the American people, and he's not going to stop, apparently, now that he's actually in charge. This is one of those moments where you do have a situation where legislative realities come smack into an agenda that has been very ambitious from day one. But I think that what is clear about this Obamacare incident is that Donald Trump is going to be demanding certain things of Republicans in Congress. He wants them to deliver on these promises. And they are going to have to work to find ways to both keep his sort of statements realistic given what they can do with the level of representation that they have, but also that recognizes the process that has to play out just according to the way that our government works, that this legislation has to be formed and moved through.
Given the confusion about what Republicans want as a replacement for Obamacare, if you are going to do a substantially different health care reform law, it cannot be done immediately. It's not possible. If repeal and replace happen close to simultaneously, what it will be replaced with is something that is 85% Obamacare, rebranded with a few small changes, because there's not a full-blown thing that
exists.
I think there are a few important things for the president-elect to keep in mind. He should think about a previous president, the incumbent president's grandiose promises about if you like your health care, you can keep it. We're going to cover everybody. Nobody's going to be worse off. Those are dangerous promises to make. Also announcing that you're going to have an immediate replacement when you have a 60-vote threshold in the Senate. That's also going to be very hard.
And doing health care reform only with Republican votes. The biggest mistake Barack Obama made was doing health care reform with only Democratic votes. If Donald Trump does it with only Republican votes, it will be the same mistake.
And that won't be physically possible.
All right. Unfortunately, physically possible is also us. We have limitations ourselves. Today's guests were Vice President-elect Mike Pence, West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin, and former Speaker Newt Gingrich. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager. The senior producer is Jill Jackson. This broadcast was directed by Brian Nailsman. Face the Nation originates from CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com, and you can follow Face the Nation, John Dickerson, and CBS Radio News on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Face the Nation is also rebroadcast on our digital network, CBSN, at 2 and 6 p.m. Eastern, every Sunday.